A brief disclaimer. Parts of this interview discuss publicly traded securities. This discussion is for informational purposes only and does not represent investment advice of any kind. At the time of recording, the principals of MJ Research Corp. had long positions in Columbia Care, Cresco Labs, Curaleaf, Green Thumbs Industries, Harborside, Mercer Park Acquisition Corp., Schwazze, and WM Technology. The principals of 8th Revolution have multiple positions across the industry. Our content is intended for informational entertainment purposes only. We encourage you to seek independent financial advice from a professional to verify any informational claims you hear on our podcast. Thank you, and let's get into it.
This is The Dime. Dive into the cannabis and hemp industry through trends, insights, predictions, and tangents.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of The Dime. As always, I've got my right-hand man, Kellen Finney, here with me. And this week, we've got a very special guest, Colin Farian and Mike Regan of MJ Research. Gentlemen, thanks for taking the time. How are you doing today?
Pretty good. Thanks
so much for having us, Brian.
Yeah, we're stoked to kind of dive into a variety of different topics. And I think before we can get into MJ Research and your backgrounds, I think we should start with one of the hardest questions there is in the game, which is, living and deceased, gentlemen, who is your ideal cannabinoid session with? Colin, go first.
Ideal cannabinoid discussion?
Session. So a smoke session.
Session. Ooh, man. It's hard because there's a lot like between, you almost have to subsection it between the folks that really established the industry and the folks that are moving it along. I would say in the folks that are moving it along, Ben Kobler is probably an easy option. And folks that have got us to where we are now. I mean, is Steve D'Angelo too easy of an option? I go with those two.
Mike?
I guess sort of implicit in that is, are you saying like we're actually everyone smoking up and actually discussing everything? Because yeah. I'm actually not an enormous consumer. But I actually do have a good memory of one, which was the Fish Show in Worcester in June 2012, where I think the entire hockey arena was hotboxed. So that was a pretty good smoke session of, just really good music and then, just a good vibe for, 10,000 people.
That's nice of the 10,000 people to put that on for everyone else.
I was more amazed is like, I've seen this in a minivan. I've never seen this in the DCU Center.
All right. So what are your guys' choices?
You're going to have us come back for that. So go for it, Kellen.
Elon Musk, right?
Yeah.
Just like Joe Rogan on his podcast, it'd be nice to have him on and smoke some weed and chat. What about you, Brian?
Mark Cuban, probably. He'd probably be too high energy for me, though. It'd probably give me some anxiety because we'd just be ripping through ideas. And I'd be like, all right, well, this session went completely. Let's head back to the question. So let's dive into your backgrounds. Obviously, cannabis is a really unique space. How did either of you guys get into the space? Mike, you want to go first?
Sure. In terms of getting into the cannabis space, I basically joined about 2 years ago. Well, it really gets again more about 3 years ago. My background is basically a lifelong long short equity investor at various hedge funds and on the sell side, doing primarily fundamental, bottoms up research, investment research, but have done some quant as well. A few years ago, I was looking at Scott's Miracle-Gro on something totally unrelated to cannabis. It was a pricing power thesis versus Home Depot and Lowe's. And I had to figure out what this Hawthorne division was they had, which, became pretty quickly obvious what it actually was really doing. So that, and I was like, this is actually pretty interesting, which also coincided, I guess, with the Canadian, the Canadian stocks ripping up to insane valuations. Through that, just doing that research, I found MJ Biz Daily is a good source of information for the industry. Just looking at to educate myself on like what this whole thing could be. And then they had a job posting for, we're launching a premium financial service. We need someone, we can teach you cannabis, but we need someone who knows everything that's not cannabis, financial analysis, company analysis, company strategy, valuation, things like that. So I joined them in 2019 to write for their premium investment service. They were calling it Investor Intelligence at the time. And then that was going great until COVID hit and they had to retrench given, that there was no conference in Vegas, no MJ BizCon. But I still thought the general concept was a good idea and got pretty convinced of the overall long-term macro freight train investment theme, for the next 10, 20 years, you know, I think cannabis will be a pretty interesting investment theme to know better, and has a lot of market inefficiencies. So I've launched MJ Research Co. to basically continue that concept of, you know, institutional professional grade investment research on this nascent industry that's, you know, going to have a lot of legs to it, and, you know, a lot of long and I think eventually short opportunities across both this sector and other sectors, and, you know, whole supply chain and disrupting traditional industries as well. So that's basically what that brings me to here. And I can let Colin jump in on his thoughts.
So I started like pretty traditional finance background up in Craig-Hallum in Minneapolis, which is a boutique research-driven investment bank, and was lucky enough to get hired for a long short fund in Boulder, Colorado. And after a couple of years working, doing equity research analysis on the buy side, I actually underwrote a company called Emhar Dean back in 2016, 2017, or 2015, maybe. Regardless, this was at the time when cannabis companies were literally grown out of a storage locker in Boulder. They had rented out three of them, tore down the walls. They had this huge cultivation just like right off of Pearl Street, which is downtown Boulder, if you're familiar. So underwrote that. That did not go well. You can still, I think it's publicly traded at this time, but sparked my interest in the industry and moved from equity research and want to get a little bit more empathy for the operator roles. So I switched into the cannabis industry, where at first I had co-founded a company that was doing computer vision over crops called Deep Green. We were detecting like pests and pathogens and doing a bunch of IPM work with companies. And that transitioned into a role at Urban Grow, which is a picks and shovels company, where I was directing all MSO accounts, doing strategic operations for cultivations and then ongoing operations for cultivations, so like maintenance, IPM, and then design strategy. And then I found Mike probably like a couple years later, listening to a podcast, and was thinking that I want to get back in the investment world. And so I reached out to Mike and said, hey, I want to build the exact same thing that you're building. Would you have me? And here we are today.
A true cannabis love story. Let's dive into MJ Research. You know, what is the value that it brings to the industry, and who does it really target from an informational sense?
Well, like I was saying, we think we're stronger together than apart as well. So, you know, it's like this will work. Our strengths sort of complement each other, just in terms of I have more experience, you know, living through the internet boom and bust and resurgence and the housing boom and bust and, you know, multiple market cycles and looking at every industry. And Colin has super deep knowledge on, you know, the plant and cannabis itself. In terms of the firm, you know, we're basically trying to target accredited institutional grade or just, you know, institutional investors. We're basically providing what the research that we would want if we were running, you know, a fund, or if we were at a fund and we're like, hey, this is the morning email to my portfolio manager, the things I've been seeing that we should be doing. You know, we're basically trying to bring that institutional level, professional grade analysis to this sector. Because we see a need for it. And as it increasingly matures, I think that's also, there's going to be an increase in demand for that among a lot of investors that currently can't, you know, because of the federal legality of their own, you know, investment mandates or the, you know, where things trade, they can't invest directly in the space. But we think that's going to keep changing with increasing legalization. So, and on top of that, it's a very, very complex space, you know, especially like on the capital structures. We can go into that later. I've never seen capital structures this complex. The regulations are always changing. It's a bunch of micro markets. So that's basically what we're trying to do. So we're, you know, providing, we've sort of mentally divided into tools, which are, you know, the things that investors need if they want to, you know, truly have accurate, actionable information, you know, to sort of make their own decisions. You know, these are the tools they'll need, you know, in terms of like our dynamic comp table. We're working on some supply demand analyses, normalizing things across industries to help compare the companies. And then also, you know, just actionable company specific research. Like, we think this company is interesting. You should buy it. This is, we've done the research on it. You know, here's the consensus view. Here's our contrarian take on it. And, you know, here's our valuation. We're balancing those out as we're building those up. Now, if there's anything else I've missed, Colin, that you'd like to throw in.
No, I think that's great, Mike. I think what got us here and, you know, what makes us different is that when we were both evaluating the business model, we found that a lot of the folks that are providing research have an innate bias for whatever reason. If you're a sell side bank, you're trying to get a banking deal. If you're running a research site that's driven by ads, you often have relationships with the folks that are providing the advertising with you. So what we have built is a no pay to play web or platform for investment research. And I think that sets us apart as being, you know, skeptics and neutral among all the ideas we're looking at.
So before we dive into some of the trends, do each of you have a favorite operator from like a large scale and a small scale that you're kind of rooting for, or one that's kind of caught your eye that you have some information that you can share that just kind of gives some insight into some of the tremendous value that MJ Research brings to the table?
Yeah, I'll start, but I'll do a contrarian one to kick us off, especially right now. Cresco Labs has been trading down pretty significantly. The capital structure is not great. The financial disclosures and accounting have been not great. But an operational standpoint, if you look at their organizational structure and their team relative to the other MSOs, they're about as mature as it gets. These folks have an entire lean manufacturing division that's going out and figuring out how to optimize processes from dispensary down to cultivation. And this is a team of 25 to 35 across the entire. And GTI has a similar organizational structure, but honestly, it's been mostly replicated from the folks across the street at Cresco Labs. And they do really deep data analysis on every single decision that they're making, which I think is a unique differentiator, whereas everyone else in the industry seems like they're just trying to keep up with operations. And it's like they're going to throw a reverse osmosis system in their cultivation just because they don't exactly know where the city water is testing at. And they think that that might be a fix. Whereas you're going to have Cresco Labs is running individual pilots in a single grow room at each of their cultivation facilities and then making that decision, which is something that's always really impressed me.
Mike?
It's funny you're saying, you know, something you really like and you're rooting for. I try to always be independent on the, you have an investment thesis. It's a good buy at this price. I think it can go to that price for a specific reason. Well, I'll go into a little bit that we wrote up for our premium clients a couple of weeks ago when it was about 16 was Weed Maps, which now is just de-SPAC'd. We wrote about what was still Silver Spike, but, you know, looking forward on it. When I first came out, I was very excited about it because I've been looking for the NASDAQ traded ancillary company that has a good business model that can, at this point be owned by institutions looking for cannabis exposure that can't actually touch the plants. And also doesn't have any of the questions around, supply and demand on the plant side. And then when Weed Maps came out, we started writing it up actually back in January. And those early riots are actually available for, they're free. You just have to sign up. The concern was always that the illicit stores that they had in the past and the investigations as to whether they were still aiding and abetting that. So first it was saying, they removed all the stores back in 2019 in California that were unlicensed. And when we started doing our research, we actually then found that there was some stores that seemed to be taking advantage of a CBD only loophole where the listing is CBD only. But if you look around at other sites, if it's a store, it's a 123 Main Street CBD, there happens to be 123 Main Street THC at the same address with the same logo. It's like, you're not selling THC on Weed Maps. So yeah, you're not breaking any laws, but it looks like you're doing something else on the side. Then it was like, this seems a little too risky because you can't capitalize revenue that could vanish overnight, right? If there's a risk that government cracks down and says, okay, 300 of your listings have to be taken off immediately, then investors don't like that. And what we actually discovered then in May was they seemed to have actually cleaned up, all those listings that we had originally found back in January were then gone. And then on top of that, they also removed the unlicensed stores in Canada, which then if you actually do the math, it looked like all the Canadian revenue was unlicensed. So they basically abandoned all of the Canadian revenue. And that actually, in my mind, is a huge positive because it shows that this management team is actually serious. They're actually walking the talk, essentially. So then that actually then lets it have a higher multiple if the revenue stream is truly clean in that respect. And it also forestalls that the investigation from the the subpoena from the DOJ, if they're actually saying the thesis is we're a partner to the industry in terms of, or partner to the regulators in terms of only having licensed stores. So then taking that risk away, then you're just left with two-sided market, high barriers to entry on that in their markets where they dominate, generating 25% margins with a pricing story that they're both increasing the value and showing that their products are, deliver more value to their customers and raising the prices on that, which is a huge benefit for margin expansion. And then also the upsell on, software as a service, the adjacent software technology that dispensaries need. So you combine that, and then it's also, trades on the NASDAQ, doesn't actually touch the plant, doesn't pay 280E taxes today. If I'm a big mutual fund that just wants to own a tech company that happens to sell to the cannabis industry, but is not a cannabis company specifically, I can actually buy it. That all sets up for what I think is a pretty interesting long case with a good business model that generates cash, that is actually earnings positive after taxes, and has a still then benefits from the overall cannabis long thesis of increasing penetration across the U.S. So that's it in a nutshell. Won't go into sort of where I think the stock will go. We have to keep something for the premium clients in terms of our actual upsides and downsides and the risks and the such. But that's in a nutshell that I think that's a pretty compelling case in cannabis right now and the cannabis sector overall. Hopefully it wasn't too long-winded.
No, I think that's really strong. And I think you did a really good job of teasing at the end. If you want to see, the other information, sign up and we can plug the link right there in that moment. So I think you did a really good job there. So let's kind of get into some of the trends that you're seeing from a macro standpoint. Obviously, like you were saying, Mike, the cannabis industry's got a variety of different issues between 280E, the state-by-state issues. So what macro trends are you using to kind of overall guide the industry and kind of shed some light on that approach?
Just in terms of overall macro trends, it's more, understanding the individual markets and, sort of the individual margin structures of those on a macro basis. And this is more longer term that, the trend has picked up recently, but I don't think it ever really went away. It's just was dormant for a while. Will be consolidation, right? There's, in 10 years, there's probably going to be fewer larger operators, at least in the public side versus, the ones we have today. You've already seen, Trulieve is acquiring Harvest. Someone said they're like, oh, this, this means mega mergers are back. It's like, I don't think they ever really went away. It's just the industry will consolidate over time. This one just happened to happen now. We have our own reasons why we suspect it happened, on May 10th specifically, versus in a year, 2 years ago, related to Harvest capital structure and voting structure. But that's just an overall trend of, who is gaining increasing scale. And at this point, that has a benefit for access to capital in terms of the, the large players typically have sort of better access to capital and at lower costs of capital. That probably won't always be the case, though. If we have increasing legalization or safe banking, that's more of a macro trend of what levers within the companies actually start to change. And actually, we just wrote this up about inflation and cannabis. Cannabis currently has sort of the cottage industry nature of it and the nascentness of it leads to opportunities long term to improve with scale and new processes and automation. A lot of they can probably cut costs in a lot of ways. And that's more a longer-term trend that we've been looking at. And actually, Colin, you're probably better to speak about the, the scalability questions. But we're sort of looking at who can operate efficiently, and that doesn't necessarily mean who has the highest margins today. Because I could have 100% margins tomorrow if I fired everybody, and June would be a great month, but then July would fall off a cliff. Right? You can't operate a business that way. So just because you have high margins today doesn't mean that you're necessarily going to be able to maintain those margins as your business gets bigger or as, as the time changes. So I don't know, Colin, if you want to reflect on some of those concepts.
Yeah, I'll start with the macro trends that we've been looking into. I can note are the scalability and then supply demand. And so the scalability side is just that, you guys know as well as anyone that MSOs at this point are much closer to startups than they are to established public companies, like incumbents and industrials, right? So when you look under the hood at these companies, it's just mayhem, like they're scaling quickly, they're hiring quickly, they're
they're acquiring companies, and you know, it's just like it, from the outside, it looks really neat. And when CEOs go and tell you like, we've got plans A, B, and C, but when you look in the inside and like, you know, going into the offices, it's like people are flying all over the place, you know, not enough desks for people type of structure. And so you look at the scalability, it's often that how disciplined are they being about making sure that their business grows? Because often in that dynamic, you have counter issue of making sure that your business can scale is going to hurt your near-term margins. And that puts this, you know, this like temporary bear thesis in front of investors where they're like, well, their margins are not nearly as good as X, Y, and Z. But in reality, they're prepping for the next 5 years, whereas companies X, Y, and Z are only prepping for today. And I think that's really important piece that you have to look at when evaluating these companies, because you want to hold them for 5 to 10 years. There's plenty of upside as the industry continues to grow. And so that's one of the macro trends we're looking at. It's everything from like, do they connect their ERP to their POS and their retailers, right? Like, is the POS and the retailer connected to a live menu that's got real integrations, or are they basically selling inventory on their live menu that they don't have, that there's dispensary that ticks off customers when they go to the store because the product isn't actually there, right? This stuff happens all the time. Then the other item is supply demand, where, you know, the companies that have the best gross margins right now are usually in states that have limited license and high flower prices. And so we've been digging into looking at the potential supply in any given market relative to the demand today and then the demand 5 years from now. So just assuming that the entire per capita population of an individual market, say like Colorado, you know, scales to maturity, and wherever that maturity is, Colorado continues to grow. So it's kind of interesting to see that move on. But if you look at a state like California, where we're doing a deep dive on right now, the potential capacity of California, they could plant more cannabis than the entire state would need multiple times over. Now, it doesn't necessarily equate into low prices because not everyone's putting plants in the ground and not everyone's actually using their licenses. But if they wanted to, and as more legislation comes on to allow more outdoor grows and greenhouses in these, you know, perfect agricultural markets, like, or submarkets like counties, Santa Barbara, Ventura, Monterey, Sonoma, that will change the entire direction of the pricing. And eventually they'll be supplying to the entire country. But for now, it puts risk on the near-term pricing trend.
Hi, y'all. I'm Joe, host of Casually Baked, the podcast. If you're looking for a one-of-a-kind cannabis-infused getaway, I invite you to join me in the beautiful wine and weed country of Sonoma County, California. As a cannabis lifestyle guide, I've cultivated a one-of-a-kind farm-stay experience where you can enjoy the casually baked lifestyle and the magic of sun-grown cannabis farms and vineyards. Now, if you're into wine, weed, or both, get ready to have a high time customized just for you. Learn more at casuallybaked.com/travel. That's casuallybaked.com/travel.
I think that's perfectly said. And I want to dive into Callan, because I know we've been to some operators that are one of the largest in the space and been overwhelmingly surprised by the way they handle their business. And we kind of were blown away to think that like these guys are doing tremendous numbers. And we got in there and it's like you were saying, Colin, it's chaotic. And we kind of looked at each other like, wow. And it's one of those where we just kind of got like an inside look and just couldn't believe how that was going. So Callan, you want to shed some light on that experience and kind of piggyback off what Colin was saying?
Yeah, that's funny that you brought that up, because that's exactly where my head was at. And I was also debating. I was like, probably shouldn't say the name of the company or anything like that. But it's completely accurate, right? Like, we went into their facility and checked it out, and I was just like, what are you guys doing? I was like, this is a total dumpster fire. This is one thing. You guys are not doing that. I was like, all of this other stuff you guys already bought, no one unboxed it. It's just sitting here in a corner and you're outsourcing that. I was like, what are you guys doing? And so it's absolutely insane. And just like you said, people are running around. They're like, we don't have enough boxes for the cartridges, like the wrong cartridges. Like, this order was supposed to go out yesterday. And they're just all like, what do we do? And it's just insane. And they need high quality people, and the training and all these things are just so underappreciated. And like in an established industry where they have this system for onboarding people and getting them trained and having them all check all these boxes and having them competent, like all those systems aren't in place yet. And they're all so fluid within these companies because they're all still trying to figure it out, because it's not like there's a rubric for how you run a company that has operations in every different state that's a micro market. You know what I mean? So they're having to figure this all out on the fly, which is clearly has been a challenge. You know what I mean?
Funny, because like if you didn't know them, you would have trouble imagining that they were multi-billion dollar industry leaders.
We kind that's of assumed exact- that they'd be so much more put together and that none of these issues would arise. And then we kind of like took a step back and we thought about it. It's like they're scaling so fast that they're not even able to consider it, right? They bought us equipment because someone made that decision. And then as Kellen said, he's like, they've got $1 million paperweight in the corner just collecting dust. And they need that piece of equipment that they're outsourcing because likely the person that made that decision got hired and moved on to the next role. And then the person that came in was like, I didn't buy that. I don't know where that goes. And I mean, this is the part of the industry that kind of excites me the most, because unless you've been there, you don't realize that like that's all easy money that they're going to, once they get like in a rhythm and start optimizing.
Yeah, I think that points to, I guess, two other trends that we see. And the first is, you know, cannabis industry is not just, you know, people growing the plants and selling dispensaries. It's the entire supply chain that will need to grow up along with this. Like part of the reason it might be so chaotic is that there isn't the go-to, a normal company just calls up, you know, the go-to outsourcer, like, hey, we need this to be done. Just do it. Okay, fine. They do it. There's a whole supply chain that hasn't been built yet that needs to be built. So it'll be all these other companies that, yeah, we don't actually touch the plant. We don't actually, you know, we service the cannabis industry and help them, you know, better organize it. And then also just sort of how the margin structure changes. And this is more for investors that we try to think a lot about, you know, is the margins you see today will probably change versus in the future, in terms of first, it's how much you have to scale up that infrastructure as you grow. Second is also what happens as, especially with 280E, I wonder if that is, at least for the US operator, sort of propping up some of the margins, because implicitly any margin has to sort of cover the taxes, right? So if all of a sudden you take 280E away, you know, then it's not like all that money just flows to investors and investors just get all that. You know, the management teams are going to look at it and think, okay, well, now we're not writing that, you know, check to the government. What can we do with that instead? We can reinvest it in marketing, reinvest in hiring more people, maybe even reinvest it in, you know, either lower prices or, you know, you've seen in competitive consumer industries, they quote, invest in price. The grocery stores do that all the time. And that basically is just a price cut. So, you know, that if you take out that enormous cost to them right now, and then no one has it, you know, what I've seen in other industries, like, this happened in 2017 with the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, when, you know, the government just universally lowered the corporate tax rate for everybody from like 35 to 21%. Businesses that had strong, you know, that weren't very competitive bought back stock, but companies that were in competitive consumer businesses and industrial businesses, a lot of them just spent more money on the things they were already doing. Like they accelerated strategic growth plans, or they were forced to give people raises. Because like, well, you know, we're reinvesting back in our employees, we're reinvesting in price, we're reinvesting in, you know, product quality. And, you know, it's not like that money was just kept by investors. But since EBITDA, which is what the industry is usually valued at, is a pre-tax measure, you know, you have this scenario where EBITDA margins go down, net income margins or the after-tax margins actually go up. And it's a question of, are investors looking closely enough at that dynamic? Because if you just see declining EBITDA margins, you'll freak out. You're like, oh, this is terrible. Your margins are going down. I don't want this. It's like, well, they're going down, but you're making more money. So that's actually a good thing. And our cost of capital is lower because, you know, a tax cut's the cheapest form of capital possible, right? I don't have to, the government's just not taking as much money. Great. You know, I don't have to like go, you know, pay interest to debt holders or dilute the equity holders with more shares, right? So it's actually all good, but not in the simplistic, oh, you know, 21% of gross profit goes into my pocket, says the investor. That won't happen.
Yeah, nothing in cannabis is simple like that. So I want to ask a different question. Vertical integration, does that help the operators, you think? Because we were talking about all the challenges with scaling. So vertical integration as a whole, are we in favor of it? And from an investment side, do you think it's beneficial? Do the investors understand the challenges and the complications of being vertically integrated and having to have all these efforts and all these resources? And then the inability to kind of perfect a certain area of the supply chain. Colin, do you want to go first?
I might tease and then hand off to Mike. So I think that there's a bit of nuance that vertical integration is good for from an investment standpoint and for operators right now. In the future, it won't be. So at this point, you've got relatively wide margins across the supply chain. You move from cultivation to processing, cultivation manufacturing to processing to dispensaries, even delivery. But eventually that gets more competitive. So in these limited license, let's back up. In these limited license states, you have vertical integration. You can sell from your cultivation to your retail or even doing your cultivation to wholesale and make plenty of money. Now, you see margin compression when you look at a competitive market like California or Oklahoma, even Colorado, with the exception of this year where margins have gotten better, back to a better place. But take California, for example, when the prices go down, you see margins getting squeezed across the supply chain. It generally starts further downstream and then works its way back up, and you have a shakeout of operators, which is not obviously great for investors. But if you're in Pennsylvania, you basically make money hand over fist. Florida is a better example because you're vertically integrated and because everyone else is locked out. Now, I think in the future, as it gets more competitive, more players come into the space and more people are specialized, like there's a very low probability that someone that has operations in 12 different states and has vertical integrations is going to be able to compete with a herbal in California, right? It's a super well-run business run by people that have former experience in food distribution. The idea that like someone will be able to compete for a core competency when that's all they do every single day, it seems far-fetched. So that's my general take. Good for now, bad for later.
Mike?
The general concept is exactly. Thinking fourth dimensionally, if you will, it's when in the industry growth cycle is it attractive. Right now, the lack of a reliable supply chain across the whole sector is what we were talking about before, that there's going to be this whole ancillary supply chain that needs to get built as well. You kind of have to be vertically integrated because, you know, the one thing that's your bottleneck to your product, if you can't get it, you got to do it yourself. You know, writing up that, you know, Ford for Model Ts during after World War One needed to be vertically integrated. They owned forests and iron mines and railroads and glassworks, you know, because they were sick of supply chain disruptions and there just wasn't a reliable supply chain. But Ford doesn't do any of that today because there's an entire mature supply chain. We're nowhere near that yet. So today, you know, having the benefit is having the greater guaranteed supply of product, control over your quality, you know, and things like that. That is more important than, you know, shaving an extra 5% off of a supply contract. But you fast forward and all of a sudden, if there's robust wholesale markets or companies that specialize in each part of the supply chain, that, you know, when you have that specialization, they'll probably be able to do it better and more efficiently because they're, you know, like Colin said, they're really good at that one thing. Then it makes more sense to, you know, it's cheaper and better just to hire the outsource this to the person who knows how to do it perfectly, but we're not there yet. And then, yeah, it's also a lot of laws force that, and you can kind of get away with it because it is still micro markets. But, you know, if all of a sudden you took away those micro markets, you're going to see, I think, a lot more specialization over the longer term. That's a general answer, but that's I think where we're going over the long term.
Dylan, you want to touch on that?
As far as vertical integration goes, I think the one area I look at it is more of an optimistic perspective. I think that vertical integration is really good for all these companies to approach right now because all of these different management teams have strengths and they all have weaknesses. And I think in 10 years, they're going to figure out that, hey, our team is really, really good at this section of the supply chain. Right. And then they're going to cut the fat, and then that's going to help establish that robust ancillary wholesale market and that supply chain for outsourcing. Right. And you're going to see all these companies kind of just go and fit into what they're really good at. Right. And so if they're doing everything and they find out, hey, we have employees that are absolutely phenomenal at understanding purity of water and all these things, right, from a cultivation perspective, and then they double down on that and then they start outsourcing the other things, I think that that's going to be really, really strong for the whole industry as a whole, right? And so I think that you're going to see more and more companies start to put resources into the areas that they're really skilled at, right? Whether that's retail, production, or extraction, or cultivation, or even some of the ancillary services like Weed Maps and other companies like that, right? And so I think it's really good for the industry. I think it's tough now, though, because these companies are forced to do things on their own, and it's going to significantly affect the margins because they aren't as good at it as, say, another operator or a company down the line in 10 years, right? And it also makes it really, really messy. What are your thoughts on vertical integration, Brian?
I think everyone said it perfectly here. I just don't think people outside the industry realize actually how challenging that is. And Colin, you lightly touched on that. When you have 12 different states with 12 different regulations and you're trying to be vertically scaled, the challenge and the complexity of being good at everything is really, really, really hard. At the end of the day, right, supply chain disruption, if you don't have flower products and you're not controlling the supply chain, you're not selling flower products. So at the end of the day, you kind of have to, and we all agree. And I think that's part of the excitement that I personally have is that once some of these challenges are lifted off these operators and they can really double down on what you were saying, Kellen, on what they're good at, you're going to see kind of the best kind of move to the forefront. And then at the end of the day, you'll see those numbers kind of follow too. But right now we're all in agreement, kind of has to be the way it has to be. Good now, bad later.
Well, I guess an interesting point on that, like a trend we've noticed recently is the larger operators are starting to invest more in cultivation. You just saw Curaleaf just bought, where they're in the process of buying Los Sueños, which is the largest cannabis grower in Colorado. It's basically, you know, a giant outdoor farm in Pueblo. And that was interesting to me. You know, if you look back a year ago, you know, Curaleaf bought Blue Kudu, which was a little edibles kitchen and processor. It wasn't to buy the Blue Kudu brand. I'm guessing it was just buying the assets and the distribution that they had in, I don't know, 200 stores at the time. It's probably more now to, you know, basically convert that to Select, to blow out the Select brand. But I guess someone in that company has decided we need to have a better control of the supply. And they bought the largest supplier that, you know, I think to date has been mostly wholesale. You know, they sold most of their goods wholesale to other growers. You know, what happens when Curaleaf, you know, then buys that largest supplier? You know, are they looking to basically sell wholesale in Colorado, or are they looking to, you know, guarantee supply? And then, you know, how much of that supply is just going to go into Select? You basically go into the Blue Kudu kitchen and then just pump out Select products for the Colorado market. I'm not sure, but it's, you know, it's interesting in that we're seeing this trend of additional, you know, people investing in additional larger scale cultivation. You know, stuff Columbia Care buying that giant greenhouse in Long Island, you know, and Glass House is coming public by the SPAC. That's, you know, they're going to have a giant, they're basically converted, you know, giant greenhouse in California, you know, to then blow out that more in a retail wholesale, you know, joint thing. And that goes back to the whole, over time, you're probably going to see greater scale. And you know, the question is, the larger operators that have probably better access to capital right now, consolidating a bunch of smaller growers, then you'll have, you know, that can be the step function up in sort of margin and capital availability near term. And then longer term, how much cultivation do they want or need? But that's a far longer term question. There's plenty of cultivation to consolidate in the near term.
What's the saying go? Like, better to have and not need than need and not have. And kind of when you relate it back to the pandemic, when you would go to the food store and there'd be nothing left, but like a couple like leftover pieces of bread, and people are like, well, I guess this will do. Sometimes it feels like when people go to a dispensary and they're out of products and there's like a couple random pieces left, people are like, well, that's perfect. Like I came here, I waited in line for 2 hours. Like, and this is all that's left. Perfect. I'll take that. And right now, like, we don't really know what the demand of cannabis is. We just know it's more and more. So let's go into another trend. We talked about the trends that you're seeing. Let's talk about trends you're not seeing that you'd like to see. What type of trends are out there that you think we'll see soon? Colin?
I guess it's an easy segue. Like, trends that we'd like to see soon would be more operators focusing on their core competencies. So as Kellen mentioned, like, that's a great point that a lot of these folks, you're starting to see who wants to be good at what. And sometimes we're even seeing who's good at what, but it's not always the same. And so when you look at, maybe like, let's use the Curaleaf example, right? Does anybody really want to own a outdoor farm in Southern Colorado? No, probably not. But if you can sell your products at a price competitive rate to go and get market share and get more distribution doors, because you want to build a brand, then it's super, super valuable. And that's exactly why Curaleaf is going out there. So yeah, at this point in time, it's kind of like a necessary evil to go out and find these certain types of assets, because at the end of the day, like, there's a ton of variables. You guys know as well as anyone, given the exposure to Colorado, that like, it's, we've got really tough weather to forecast, and it's like the growing season is long, but like the idea that, you know, the chance of you having a snowstorm in September is not low. And you're literally out there hand picking flower at that point, like the day before the snowstorm comes, because you've only had a day of warning. Coming back to the point though, seeing folks that go into focusing on their key competencies Which you've seen, I think it used like Cresco with wholesale. They've shown that they really want to focus on pushing wholesale and getting distribution doors. And that's fine. And that's great. There's a place in the market for that. I think you've historically seen like Jushi focus on retail. That's starting to turn a little bit because they want to build margins. And so they started to get more cultivations. But I'd like to see more focus on core competency going forward. And I realize that it's not, you know, especially rational at this point because you have to own across the supply chain, but it'll be interesting to see how that pans out in the future.
Mike?
I can basically think of two of them. The first one, and we're starting to see this, but I mentioned before, is just the complexity of the capital structures with so many warrants and options and converts that I think the overall industry will benefit when those capital structures are simpler and the share counts are simpler from just higher multiples. As at this point, I guess most of the investors either don't know or they're close enough to it that they've already done all the math. But as this industry courts more and more institutional investors, it's a question of whether they'll be able to sort of wade through these very complex, and it's more of the dynamism of the share count, right? The share count changes as the stock price changes, right? That's basically what the warrants do. So, if you're doing evaluation on a company and, you think there's 100 million shares, well, yeah, there's 100 million shares at $10, but when the stock doubles to $20, all of a sudden, there's 15 million shares and all of a sudden it's not $20 anymore. It's, it's $15 or something like that, right? The industry will benefit overall to the extent that they can use less and less, issue less and less warrants on future capital raises. And I get that that's been in part the capital constrained nature of the sector. So it's slowly happening, but that'll think it will benefit the industry. I think, more traditional companies in that supply chain aspect, we'll start to see more traditional companies start to look at supplying this space as just another customer. I guess the money laundering laws and the banking laws, that can complicate things, and, or the insurance, it may be perfectly legal to do something, but you call up your insurance agent and they're like, well, if you supply this cannabis company, all of a sudden your insurance rates are going to quintuple because, this is crazy risky for us. We're not going to let you do it. So it's effectively, you effectively can't service them. I think that's a trend I would like to see change, is just the industry gets more, more normalized, just like it's just a standard consumer pharma product. It's going to have a whole agricultural industrial supply chain, just like any other business. And it needs to be supplied by, you do the exact same thing for soft drink company. Why can't you do it for, this cannabis company, right? I think that's coming, and that's the trend. I'd like to see more of that. And I think you will see more traditional companies start to get involved in the space over time.
Guys, I want to talk to you today about one of our new partners, CESC. CESC is a nonprofit organization providing a compelling and complementary alternative. They represent the ability to harness a flexible, collaborative approach to scientific advancements. They are comprised of leading doctors and researchers in the cannabis and cannabinoid science space for almost a decade. Their act first, talk later operating principle has now led to a successful series of disruptive innovations in the cannabis science space. They need your help now. Join them, collaborate with them, or support them. Go to thecesc.org to get involved now. Together, we can change the world.
Can I end one more?
Do it.
This is not investment based, but lower THC product. We don't all need to have 25% THC flower or 100 milligram THC drinks. This has got to be a thing of the past. And as we get more people that are new to the industry, it becomes a liability more than anything, right? Like a 10 milligram piece of chocolate, just break in half, put less THC in it. More companies will have more luck. Can's shown that can happen. I realize there's barriers to the idea, but it's got to be something that happens in the near future for the CPG companies.
That's a whole other conversation for another time, because in some people's mind, more is always better, right? And when you're first time into a dispensary and you're not really sure, the higher the number, the more attractive it is. And sometimes the bud tender is more likely to recommend it. And then you've just got yourself a circle of issues, because whose role is what? And that's a whole other conversation for another time. But I want to kind of quickly switch gears and go back to the margins conversation. We talked about kind of comparing operators, and margins is an easy way to likely do that, but sometimes it's very misleading. So in your opinions, can you compare operators in the cannabis space solely by margins? And if not, what sort of other initiatives, if you're new to the space, would you use to kind of compare operators to make an investment into the space?
I think you start with margins, but then it's understanding the stories behind why those margins are the way they are, because you could have a low margin for two reasons. You could have a low margin because you're investing for the future. So if you sort of break it into, well, my sustainable margin is, I'm going to make up numbers here that, it's 30, but I'm investing 10% of sales for this infrastructure in the future. That's why it's 20. That's a very different story than, our product just doesn't have very good branding power and we just have to keep cutting prices because our product sucks and that's how we compete. That's a very different reason of why are you at 20% margin instead of 30, just to make up round numbers, right? That would require us like going in and understanding, what is the margin structure? Why is it that way? And then Colin and I have talked about this also just properly adjusting for them because this may also be a trend for the overall industry. They would all benefit if they, try to show their, try to report their financials in, sort of as clean a way as possible. More information is always good to let investors make more adjustments as they see fit. But sometimes, the headline, adjusted EBITDA might include things that investors would be like, well, is that really one time? Should we really be excluding that? Are you just, and that's sort of a trick. And it's not just cannabis. A lot of companies will do that. They'll throw recurring things into the one-time line. It's like, wow, your one-time expenses are always something big. The individual thing may be one time, but like you always have a big one-time expense. I'm just going to keep that recurring, right? So it comes down to understanding why they are the way they are. And then I think longer term, comparing it to what similar industries do that aren't even in your same space, right? If, most consumer companies are earning more like 20% margins, how sustainable is a 40% margin? Well, that's the question. And then saying, okay, well, it's different because of this, this, and this. Okay, well, this probably goes away. This may change. And this actually may be permanent. So maybe it's, 30. I mean, I'm just, throw around round numbers. But that concept of what's the story behind them. I mean, you do ultimately have to compare them both on the level, but also the sustainability. That's what I think is most important from like an investment standpoint is it's great what they are, but what are they going to be?
Colin?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty inclusive answer. We would add that like we do checks, behind the margins of the more qualitative items, like who are employees turning over? Are they recruiting other employees from competing MSOs? How is talent acquired basically or lost? Where are they investing on their infrastructure side, whether it's capital equipment or they're investing in technology platforms to make, as we talked about before, the scalability, everything more efficient? And then generally, how do they make decisions, which is a tougher one to gauge because you kind of have to be speaking with the core operating team, because generally from the executive team, you get like a pretty templated answer about stuff like that. But you can kind of parse a lot of the takeaways out of looking how historically they've made investments in the past, and then even how they shape those investments in the public view, because obviously there's always a deeper read than what's in the press release.
Yeah, I think those are both really well said. And I think that's exactly the value that, your team brings to the space. So I would encourage anyone who's kind of interested in learning about the industry to kind of dive into MJ Research's platform and to kind of get involved, right? Because the only way to really know is to work with experts like yourself to kind of go there. So before we go into prediction time, we ask our guests a couple of different questions. We'll start with you, Colin. Biggest misconception in the cannabis space?
I think we've touched on this quite a bit in the podcast. It's that these billion-dollar industry leaders are all buttoned up and smooth sailing, and it operates like Apple or some other big industry incumbent. I think that is misunderstood, to say the least.
Mike?
I guess from an investor perspective, I guess maybe you see sometimes this more in some of the companies themselves, but the cannabis industry is its own unique thing, has its own special valuation metrics and special things. As I see it, it's, it's a rapidly growing growth industry, but it's still, a consumer product with, a capital intensive supply chain that needs to be built out, and a capital intensive business. And you should view it within the lens of whatever that of the consumer or industrial or agricultural portion that, you have to figure out which individual company is actually what it has more or less of each of those things. But it's not like cannabis is really special because of this. This is from the business standpoint, to be clear. It's a consumer product. It's rapidly growing. But if you're going to do valuations, you should look out to when the growth slows down. So look out 5 or 10 years and then you know, put normal consumer multiples on that 5 or 10 years out and then discount it back. But it's not like, oh, you know, this should trade at 50 times revenue because it's cannabis. It's like, no, that's, no one should do that analysis of like, oh, well, I think it's going to go to 55 times revenue. The reason you do that is because, you know, putting a normal consumer multiple on the far out growth and discounting it back implies 50 times a day, but it's really just, you know, 3, 4, or 5 times revenue, or, you know, a more reasonable net income PE, you know, 20 times PE on my 2030 estimate, right? That's how it should be viewed. And that's how we try to view it, is, you know, what do you actually do? Okay, you cultivate a product and then you process it and then you sell it in a retail establishment. You know, how is that compared to other companies that do something similar?
If you could sum up your experience into a main takeaway or lesson learned to pass onto the next generation, what would that be?
All experience?
Yeah, cannabis. Like any experience, something that you've learned in the cannabis industry that for the next generation you wanted to pass on a lesson, something that a wide-eyed freshman walking into a college who's eager to get into the cannabis industry and they're ready to start their career when they graduate. What lesson have you learned or main takeaway that you'd want to pass on to them? Something that you could share as like a guidance lesson.
I've got 2 sons. They're not quite college age. They're, you know, 9 and 11, but I try to do that every day in terms of like, what am I trying to teach these kids to prepare them for the next, you know, 30 years? And it's, I don't know, my general concept is to, you know, think critically for yourself, study history to see what has happened before, because human behavior tends to, I think, repeat itself, or, you know, people tend to operate in patterns. So we get good at pattern recognition, but also then think critically for, you know, don't just be stuck with certain analogs of the past, like, oh, this cannabis example is like, oh, alcohol was prohibited and then went legal. It's going to look exactly like that. It, you know, that can be a model to help you think about what will happen in the future, but you still have to think critically. You know, and I guess the other key lesson is just to always try to disprove yourself, right? It's the logical concept of like with the black swan example, you know, the 1,000th white swan doesn't prove that all swans are white. It's that the one black swan disproves that all swans are white. So try to find the thing that, if this is my hypothesis, what would disprove it? And then look for that. But those are the general lessons I think apply in sort of any environment and help you react quickly to the macro hand that the world deals you.
Well, I don't think I'm going to top a Nassim Taleb analogy life experience. I'll go higher level just because I don't want to compete. But I think it's, you know, it tends to be like that stereotypical phrase of like, you know, building your network is, I think network is net worth, right? But what I've learned, especially through like coming through equity research and then getting into the cannabis industry, is always that there's always someone that's smarter than you that's going to be able to provide you a ton of information that will shortcut your ability to get to where you want to go, whether it's in a career or a life decision or whatever it is. And if you are proactive on reaching out to those folks, more often than not, surprisingly, they're willing to share their advice, which has been, you know, I think you realize that as you get older and older, but like being able to find those folks that are willing to just help, despite even like not necessarily having a full relationship with you. First off, it builds a relationship, but then second off, it gets you to where you need to be much faster than if you were to go out and try and do all of the digging on your own. So I found that valuable both in cannabis, but then also just in having like general mentors from my past roles at older companies. And it's been super helpful.
Those are two of my favorite answers that I've heard so far since we've done that. Last time either of you have consumed any cannabinoids?
Last weekend, I tried the cookies pancake. Pancakes. I actually have it right here. It's sitting across my desk. But yeah, it's called cookies pancakes. I've never tried cookies before, so I just wanted to see what it's all about. It was relatively new to Colorado, I think like last year. And I know the farm that's been growing the strains. So it tastes sweet. Maybe like pancakes, maybe might be a self-fulfilled taste, but otherwise good.
Bond rating is a good.
Let's see. I think about a week ago, I had an edible, like a little gummy. It was, you know, fine. And then, you know, went to sleep soonish afterwards and had a nice, nice sleep. So nothing crazy or exciting.
The sleep edibles are the best. Well,
the hypothetical smoking up with Trey Anastasio, which, yeah, from the beginning of it, that We'll see if that ever becomes a reality.
The full circle experience. All right, prediction time. 2030, which big operator outside of the cannabis space has now entered the cannabis space and taken a big position?
Are we talking operators to ancillary?
Yeah, so it can be anyone that's outside, currently outside the cannabis space that has aggressively moved in to try to claim some market share in any of the verticals or any of the revenue opportunities in cannabis.
I'll go first. I'll do maybe a sleeper and then an obvious. Sleeper, I think Mike and I have gone back and forth on this, but we're going to see packaging companies live in this oligopoly of like five that own the entire market share. And the idea that someone's going to innovate something completely new and special when these guys have been doing it for decades or even longer seems like it'd be really, really tough. And so I fully expect that the balls of the world will be going in and taking a run on all things packaging, especially given that right now you have just so much just like wasteless plastic, and it's really hard to build a packaging company in the first place because molds cost a ton of money and you can't really raise startup capital for it because it's a relatively low margin business. So I like that one from the outside. And I would say the CPG company just seems too easy. So maybe I'll hand off to Mike. I'll come back if I think of a better one.
Yeah, the easy ones are probably, big alcohol and probably big pharma. With the caveat that this all depends on what future regulations assume, right?
2030, though, which one? If you had to take a company.
Assume by 2030, there's general legalization and interstate commerce. Then you would look for someone with large distribution capability. The obvious one there is Amazon. I'm not saying that Amazon is a cannabis stock by any means at all.
We're going to remove that part.
I'm saying do not go buy Amazon for the cannabis long-term option opportunity. That's insane.
They did just quit testing their employees though.
Well, that's the thing. But here's the thing, to my point, exactly. That is actually significant in that, look, they see, what is Amazon? Amazon is basically a distribution platform of stuff to your house. And they just want to get more stuff through their pipes to your house. So that actually makes perfect sense, assuming the laws go that way and they're already set up for it. It's just another brown box to them, right? So yeah, the larger companies moving back. So I don't know if you saw GM also is not gonna, test for cannabis anymore, which I think is a positive. That's part of the whole normalization angle. But so that, that comes, but again, that also assumes, it makes a million assumptions between now and 9 years out of how laws actually happen, right? But that's probably one. And then I think this is more on the supply chain aspect. You'll see more sort of just traditional, traditional companies having when we also have a cannabis division, or it's just even just an agricultural division that, here's our five divisions. We've got our oil and gas division. We've got our aerospace division. And now, we got our plant division, right? Which encompasses everything. You'll see stuff like that. But I guess that's less sort of like the one company that'll get into it. But I'll throw out Amazon because they're involved in everything now. Why wouldn't they be in the future, right?
Kellen?
Amazon was the one I was going to say. But I have a backup one. Just because they're going after the healthcare industry. Amazon's goal is to conquer the whole world and cannabis is part of the world. So I think Uber or Lyft. I know that delivery has high margins and I think it's a really, really attractive business in the cannabis space, right? From a startup perspective. And Uber already has the platform and the software and the drivers. And just Mike was saying, it's just another brown box to Amazon. I think that to Uber drivers, it's just another trip that they can make some money on. As same with the food delivery that they launched a couple of years ago. So I think Uber is going to be mainstay in the delivery space of cannabis by 2030.
I'm down to my third choice. Obviously, Amazon and Uber are my go-tos. And for the reasons you said, obviously, it makes a ton of sense for both of them to be in the space. And it's just another addition into whatever they're doing well. And Obviously, the theme of this podcast has been understanding what your unique selling point is, and both those companies understanding exactly what they do well, and you can provide a massive added value to the industry and kind of take off the burden to the operators, because it's just an additional headache for them at this moment. So if I were going to choose a company, I would choose Johnson & Johnson, likely for the sleep aspect of it. Obviously, people that need to relax go to some sort of products, sometimes alcohol. And from a sleeping standpoint, if there can be some advancements with the CBN and some sort of concoction to help people go to sleep, then obviously these large-scale companies are best positioned with their assets now to take advantage of that. And I think that'll be the easiest way to adopt. I think from a mass consumption standpoint by 2030, I don't think it'll be heavy THC personally. I think it'll be one of these other minor cannabinoids that it just becomes a mass adopted and is looked at as like another vitamin into the asset, into the body. So that's my standpoint. Gentlemen, before we wrap, tell our listeners where they can learn more, where they can get involved and get some of this information from MJ Research.
Well, then you can go to our website, which is mjresearchco.com. So, you know, mjresearchco.com. And that has all of our research is up there where you can sign up to be a free member where you get some free stuff. And then also the premium signups for the real media analysis that we provide. And also, if, you know, if you're an actual institution, we also offer an outsourced analyst, you know, higher fee bespoke research service as well. That can all be found there. And, you know, free members can sign up for our you know, regular email list as well, sort of a newsletter type thing that we publish for everyone for free.
Yeah, it's one of the few ones that I consume on a regular basis. So I appreciate all you guys' hard work and look forward to connecting soon. We'll link all the links in the show notes. Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much for having us, guys. Appreciate it.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
Tune into a major journey podcast today, where guests take listeners on journeys and immerse themselves in the roller coaster ride both in and out of the cannabis space that brought them to where they are today. Throughout our conversations, guests share valuable lessons that they've learned along the way that listeners can use to empower growth both in their personal and professional lives. Check out A Major Journey today on all major podcast platforms.